program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. I'm Naomi, and today I will be reading from A Place for Us by Nicholas Gage. We are resuming Chapter 15. "You haven't got a chance, Worm," said Ulysses. "I'm the only one here who's man enough to consume that piece of Turkish delight." When the fair Aphrodite reached us, she laughed again as the mangled compliments shouted at her. She paused, smiling and rocking the carriage with one hand, and answered our questions without hesitation. Her name, she said, was Angela. "An angel or not, an earthly paragon," I exclaimed. She rewarded me with a look and laughter like crystal prisms in a breeze. "No, she wasn't babysitting," she answered Ulysses' next question. "This was her own baby. Yes, she was old enough to even to have a baby." There followed a chorus of admiring remarks about what a remarkable baby this was, a virtual paragon of a baby. Tony inquired as to the whereabouts of the lucky husband and father. "I'm not married," Angela replied, without a flicker of shame. "I was, but we're separated." "What's that mean?" my friends all asked me in Greek. When I explained, Ulysses said in English, "This man, he must be crazy." "Not crazy, just too dull and boring to deserve us," she replied. "I want to fly, and he just drags me down." I nodded and quoted Balzac in a world-weary voice. "There is no object heavier than the body of someone we don't love." This time she gave me a long, quizzical look before favoring me with a smile that came out like the sun. "This man, he was not worthy of you," Fred declared. "Come out with me tonight. I will show you what a man is." "I'm afraid I'm busy tonight," Angela said. "Then we drive you home," piped up Ulysses, pointing to his car. "Thanks, but I live right down the street," she said, pausing significantly, "with my parents. So give the baby to your mother Friday, Saturday." "Go for dancing with us," pleaded Fred. "You give us the number, we call you." "But I don't have a pencil and paper," Angela replied coyly. There was a flurry of activity as Fred fished a pencil out of his pocket, and Ulysses ran to the car to rip a scrap of paper off a road map. We all gathered around as Angela wrote down a telephone number, bracing the paper on the roof of the baby carriage. Then she straightened up, looked from one eager face to the next, and walked all the way down to the end of the line, folding the paper carefully. She gave me a glance weighted with meaning and slipped it into my shirt pocket. Then, ignoring the exclamations, shouts of dismay, and whistles from my cronies, she tossed her head and strode off, pushing the baby carriage before her. The others immediately gathered around. "Can you believe that?" Ulysses fumed. "She picked Nick over a paliarchy like me, an inexperienced child." "She was just kidding," Tony grumped. "No, she goes for you, Nick," exclaimed Fred. "Must be a little crazy, but what a body. She's hot for you. This is your big chance. You just won the national lottery." "You've got to call her tonight before she comes back to her senses," Tony urged. That night, each one of my friends called me to find out if I had phoned Angela, but I hadn't yet worked up the courage. By the next evening, I decided I had better follow through before she forgot my existence entirely. When Angela came to the phone, her voice was warm and friendly, and she sounded as if she'd been expecting my call. "I'm sorry, I can't go out tonight," she said. "My baby's got a temperature, and my mother's too tired to stay up with her. But come on over after dinner for coffee and dessert. We can sit around and talk." I walked from O'Connor's to the small wood frame house nearby, and Angela opened the door, wearing an Angora sweater and a full skirt puffed out with the crinoline petticoats. She looked like a high school girl, although I knew she must be at least 4 or 5 years my senior. We sat in the kitchen, and her mother offered me coffee and chocolate cake. Soon her father came home. In answer to her parents' questions, I lied that I had just graduated and was going to college in the fall, Princeton. This seemed to please them. Eventually, Angela's mother and father went into the living room to watch television, leaving us in the kitchen, where Angela played with the baby and told me about her ambitions. Her dream, she said, was to go to New York and work in the theater. She believed her job demonstrating appliances was good training for the stage, as well as a way to earn money. But while working at a dime store demonstrating Mouly graters, she had started going out with the assistant manager, and he had eventually made her pregnant. He was a nice boy, she told me, and he had offered to marry her, but I can't spend the rest of my life married to a man who comes home and talks about the turnover in women's girdles. I'd go crazy. I need someone who can talk about theater, books, life. I feel bad being a burden on my parents, but I know one thing. I'm not going to die in Worcester. But what about the baby? I asked. I'll figure something out, she said. For now, I can leave her with my mother. And when I get a place, even if it's one room, I'll send for her. I'll take her to rehearsals with me. Finally, the baby fell asleep, and Angela put her to bed. We sat in silence until her mother came in to clear up the last of the dishes. Angela said impulsively, "This is the best time of night, right after the sun goes down. Let's go sit out in the yard in the swing." Angela's mother tried to force another piece of cake on me, then put the radio on the windowsill over the sink, so we could hear the music out in the yard. Angela led me to a wooden porch swing suspended from a branch of a huge maple tree in the back of the yard. In the perfumed twilight, we sat side by side, listening to the penguins sing Earth Angel, to the clatter of dishes. We could see Angela's mother, framed in the rectangle of light of the kitchen window, looking out our way now and then and smiling. Keeping one eye fixed on her mother, I put an arm around Angela, and she moved close to me, slowly inching up on my lap. She had on so many petticoats that they billowed over me, hiding what was going on underneath. I was startled when Angela took my free hand and put it under her petticoats, and I nearly jumped when I discovered she had nothing on under them. The next thing I knew, she had unzipped my fly. All of this clandestine activity screened from her mother's view by the layers of petticoats. Things started to move very fast. As we sat demurely on the swing, Angela, facing the house, deftly adjusted her many layers of petticoats, so that from the kitchen it looked as if she was just sitting on my lap. As the swing slowly rocked, I was drenched with sweat, experiencing a variety of sensations I had never suspected were within the reach of mere mortals. There on the swing under the maple, with the crickets stitching up the darkness and the sound of the Milton Berle show faintly audible in the distance, I entered the gates of paradise under the guidance of my ministering angel. When I left Angela's house that night, I didn't walk, but capered like the young mountain goats that leap from crag to crag above my village. I swung from tree branches, kicked tin cans, and occasionally let out a whoop of triumph. As soon as I got home, I called Fred, Tony, and Ulysses and turned to announce my initiation. They were full of envious compliments and couldn't wait to see us together. The next night, the four of us arrived at Angela's door in Ulysses Ford and drove to his house in Oxford, where at once I was the one who went into the bedroom while the others played gin rummy. By then, I had stopped asking myself how such a prize, the most beautiful, sexiest, and most intelligent of all the girls we had ever approached, had fallen to me, the youngest and most inexperienced of the gang. Evidently, I had some quality that appealed to Angela, and I wasn't fool enough to question such a windfall. I moved through the daily routine of school and worked like a zombie, physically present but mentally relieving the sweet moments I had passed with her and fantasizing about what we would do when we were next together. On the third day of our affair, I called Angela and my euphoria vanished as she told me that she wouldn't be able to see me that night. "In fact, I won't be able to see you any night, Nick," she said softly. "I'm really sorry, but Charlie came over today, and I've decided to go back with him." "Who's Charlie?" I asked as my heart thudded into the pit of my stomach and electric currents of fear radiated to my fingertips, making it hard to hold the receiver. "The baby's father, the guy from Woolworths," she explained. "We're going to get back together. He talked to me and my parents, and I guess it's for the best." "But what about New York? I thought you said he dragged you down and you wanted to fly," I reminded her, frantically trying to keep the best thing that had ever happened to me from escaping. "I said a lot of things, but it's time for me to grow up and face reality," she replied tonelessly. "That's what my folks say, and I suppose they're right. I'm really sorry, Nick. I like the way you were always quoting poetry to me. It made me feel like someone special." "You are special, Angela," I pleaded. "You can't just give up and marry him." But I didn't argue much. I could hardly protest losing something that had been such an undeserved gift in the first place. I never saw Angela again, but whenever I went into Woolworths, I always looked around, wondering which employee was Charlie, the man who had clipped my angel's wings. The loss of Angela did not send me back to the sexual desert from which she had plucked me, however. I soon learned that I had more to thank her for than just my initiation. After Angela, women somehow seemed to know instinctively that I was experienced and responded to my overtures. I rejoiced in the sudden flood of female society where before there had been only drought. Although my amatory activity would seem mild to those who climbed the barricades during the sexual revolution, it was certainly gratifying enough for me to turn my attention to my other obsession during that period of my life, finding a way to go to college. Unfortunately, as I finished my junior year, my prospects of raising tuition were bleaker than ever. My father had filed for Social Security since he could never work full-time again. Dino had had to give up his second job at Putnam and Thurston because a full-time chef was found to replace him, so he was now supporting his growing family on the $85 a week he made at Kresge's. Conta's husband, Angelo, had been through a sequence of ill-starred jobs from table talk to a Greek candy-making firm to Bay State Abrasives, but in each case he was either laid off or the company was sold from under him, so he was reduced to picking apples seasonally for $10 a day. Fotini had found a job as a hairdresser at a beauty shop on Main Street, but she earned a pittance and complained bitterly and long about the work. since Glyceria and Kanta had both quit their jobs at Table Talk when they became pregnant. Prokopi, still working at Bay State Abrasives, was the only one in the family earning a decent salary, $125 a week. From the $40 I was making at O'Connor's, I had to contribute $15 a week to help with my room and board, and I was still paying off the expenses of my accident, so there was no way I could save a penny. Even though we were all struggling to get by, however, there were consolations in our poverty. Each of my three oldest sisters had a son during that year. Glyceria quickly followed the lead of Olga and Kanta, who both had sons in 1957, by giving birth to their first child, Photios, in May 1958. That made five grandchildren for my father, all boys, and all living like brothers in our three-decker. As I watched Father with his grandsons, I realized that he was happier than he had ever been, even though his health prevented him from working. He loved overseeing the babies, taking them to Green Hill Park to play on the swings and visit the small zoo, where he taught them about the buffalo, deer, goats, and ducks. Every day he would walk them to the spa on the corner to buy ice cream or candy, or take a small grandson in his car, tucking him between his left arm and the locked door while he drove on his visiting rounds, with the baby peering happily over his shoulder. We were poorer than ever, but this was one of the best times for our family. It was like life in the Greek village, where extended families lived next to each other, a mixture of grandparents and babies, newlyweds, aunts and uncles. In our three-decker, we had a vertical version of the village clan, with the cousins growing up like siblings, my sisters and brothers-in-law providing company and support for each other, and my father presiding over it all. Although we had no money for luxuries, each Sunday, Father would put all his culinary skill into cooking a hearty noon meal, chicken and rice in a lemon and egg sauce, or lamb shanks fricasseed with herbs and greens picked from the garden in our backyard. After church, we would all eat together in the first floor kitchen, and afterward pile into two cars and drive out to Purgatory Chasm in Sutton, where the strange towering rock formations and deep ravines made us feel as if we were back in Epiros. My sisters would pick dandelion greens while the babies rolled down the slopes and threw stones into the waterfalls and streams. We were secure and happy in each other's company then, never thinking that prosperity, if it came, might fray the ties that bound us together. None of the Greeks in Worcester were making much money at that time, except for a balding, moon-faced young man named Nick Karagounis from northern Epiros. Karagounis had hit on an innovative idea that puzzled and amused his fellow countrymen, but would eventually transform the lives of hundreds of Greek immigrants in New England. My friend Fred Malidis was a distant relative of Karagounis, and one day Fred told me how his cousin was renting a little run-down store on Pleasant Street and converting it into a pizza house. Nick's selling pizza for 75 cents each, and if you buy three, you get one free, he said. How can he make any money that way after he pays the waitresses, busboys, and overhead, I asked. That's the genius of his scheme, Fred explained. There aren't any tables, no waitresses, no plates, no busboys, no overhead. It's all takeout. He makes at least 40% profit on each pizza. But pizza's not a dessert and it's not a meal, I said, unconvinced. How often will a family eat a pizza? You haven't tasted Nick's pizza, Fred insisted. It's not thin and skimpy like the Italian kind. It's got a thick crust like bread and another inch off stuff on top. Cheese, pepperoni, very spicy. A 75-cent pizza can make a meal for 3 or 4 people. Most of the Greeks in Worcester ridiculed Karagounis, and I was skeptical too. The idea of fast food was still a novelty in 1958, when McDonald's was charging 25 cents for a hamburger. I was surprised when I saw how much business Karagounis was doing just down the street from O'Connor's, where we offered a full menu at the lunch counter. He was selling pizza to go the way street vendors in Greece sold takeaway shish kebabs and gyro sandwiches. But when I told my brothers-in-law, they explained to me that when a family goes out to dinner, they want to sit down, be served, and have a choice of entrees. For a while, I considered going to work for Karagounis myself, but I was dissuaded by the hellish heat from the pizza ovens every time I went in to watch Nick expertly sliding pizzas out of the oven with a broad wooden paddle. But I had to find something that paid more than O'Connor's if I was ever to have any hope of going to college. Luckily, I would be finishing high school a semester early in January of my senior year because of the extra subjects I had added in my junior year. If I did find a good job, I could work full-time for 9 months until college began. Meanwhile, a good job remained so remote that I just kept working at O'Connor's and fantasizing about what I would do after college when I would earn so much money that I could support all my clan. I'd build a compound of 5 houses surrounding a big swimming pool, and just as we all live together now in the crowded 3-decker on Chandler Street, we would all live together into old age. But my sisters had their own dreams, especially Fotini. Tina, as we all called her by now, had been unhappy ever since we arrived in America. Even in Greece, she was the most melancholy of my sisters, always weeping and complaining of slights, and there were reasons for her discontentment. Born in a society where a female child is considered a curse and a lifelong burden because she must be trained, rigorously guarded, and finally sent off to her husband's family along with a large dowry, Tina was our mother's 4th calamity, as my grandfather would put it, and had felt unwelcome from the beginning. She was hardly more than a year old when Mana had me, the long-awaited son, whose arrival set off 40 days of celebration, and Tina had felt ignored from then on. As the most beautiful of my sisters, Tina never lacked for male admirers, but she had been so thoroughly cowed by my father's insistence on virtue and his habit of spying on her that she wouldn't speak to any man. Besides, there were no young men among the Worcester Greeks whom she found appealing. By the spring of 1958, I began to realize that we were going to lose Tina to a groom from a distant city. She was approaching her 20th birthday, and my father had decided it was time to find her a husband. The previous fall, when Glyceria had married and traveled on her honeymoon to visit her best man's home in Philadelphia, she had discovered many likely-looking bachelors there, all immigrants from part of Epiros. She told my father about them when she got back. Because immigrants followed their kin, it happened that the people leaving our small mountain region on the northern border of Greece settled in either Philadelphia or Worcester. There was much travel and intermarriage between the two colonies, and now Gregory Bocas, Glyceria's best man, could serve as a matchmaker for Tina. January 25 happened to be the feast day of St. Gregory the theologian, and every year Gregory Bocas threw himself a big name day party. So in January, Father decided that he and his youngest daughter would travel to Philadelphia to pay their respects. If Tina was the prettiest Greek maiden in Worcester, Minos Botas, 26, was one of the handsomest Greek bachelors in Philadelphia. He had recently arrived along with a brother and sister from the village of Faniki, only 20 miles down from the mountain from Leah. The three Bodo siblings had been brought over by a kind aunt and uncle because they were part of a huge family of 11 children, and their parents were hard-pressed to put food into all those mouths. Minos and his brother had been trained as cabinet makers in Greece, and everyone hoped they could earn money in America to help the rest back in Faniki. Just as Tina had always felt lost in the shadows of her older sisters and younger brother, Minos had been swallowed up by his crowd of siblings, and he too longed for glory. He nurtured dreams of becoming an actor and joined a theatrical troupe in Philadelphia, which performed melodramas in Greek. Small, dark, handsome, and intense, Minos talked passionately about his hopes for the future, which included making a fortune with his woodworking skills. Like Tina, he was clever, and at night he created his own projects. Hand-carved wooden radiator covers, which resembled fine furniture and ornate household altars for displaying icons in the eastern corner of Greek homes. He sold these creations to supplement his income from installing cabinets in Philadelphia stores. It was Minos' aunt and benefactor, a pillar of rectitude among the Greek community, who first picked Tina out as a potential wife for him. All the women were gathered in the kitchen of Gregory Boca's house, putting the last touches on the lavish St. Gregory's Day buffet. Tina sat quietly, pretty as a flower, but when she offered to help, her culinary skills quickly became apparent. A pretty orphan girl from Epiros and a wonderful cook as well, the old lady told her nephew that afternoon. When you go to Gregory's this evening, you must get to know her. Tina had been similarly appraised of Minos' good looks and advised to notice him when he arrived. That evening, with so many people in the crowded house observing them, the young couple scarcely exchanged a dozen words, but they were pleased with what they saw. Not long after Father and Tina returned to Worcester, Father received a call from Minos' uncle and aunt, saying that they would like to come up to pay a visit on us. Glykeria immediately shot off a letter to her in-laws, demanding background information on Minos and his clan. The answer came that the family was virtuous and hardworking, but huge and therefore poor. By the time Minos and his aunt, uncle, sister, and brother were formally escorted into the parlor by our father, we were rabidly curious to meet this suitor from Philadelphia. We all stared with an intensity that would have intimidated most young men, but Minos proved charming and talkative, properly deferential to my father, and gallantly attentive to Tina. When Tina went into the kitchen to get the tray of coffee and sweets, my sisters hurried in after her to hold a whispered conference. He was indeed good-looking, they said, and he seemed nice, but she shouldn't commit herself until she got to know him better. She was still young, and there was the problem of the household of siblings back in Greece, a lot of people needing financial assistance and tickets to America. This could put a strain on any marriage. She should think it over, they advised, before giving her hand to the cabinet maker from Philadelphia. These warnings were a challenge to Tina. While the aunt and uncle were chatting with my father, Tina, who had never been alone with any young man, asked permission to walk around the block with Minos to show him the neighborhood. When they came back in the door, she announced to the thunderstruck group in the parlor that she had given her word to marry Minos. Engagement parties were held in both Philadelphia and Worcester, at one of which Minos formally presented Tina with a diamond ring that cost him several months' pay. Although the handsome pair seemed passionately in love, there were some rough spots in the courtship, such as an incident at St. Spiridon's during Sunday services when Tina began to point out to her fiancé some of the young men in the congregation who had admired her. Minas, not to be outdone, countered with tales of the many young women who had pursued him. The claims of disappointed admirers escalated until the discussion climaxed with Tina taking off her precious ring and throwing it in Minas' face. Like all their disagreements, however, this one was quickly patched up. Later in private, I suggested to Tina that their stormy courtship might indicate that she and Minas should reconsider marrying, but she burst into tears and replied, "I'm in love with him. You don't understand what true love is. Someday you'll know." She had her mind made up as usual, and all her advice was no more effective than making holes in water, as the Greek proverb puts it. To Tina, marrying Minas meant that she would move to the great cosmopolitan city of Philadelphia and a whole new circle of friends and relatives. She would reign over her own home like a queen with a handsome and adoring husband, and be free at last of the stultifying atmosphere of Worcester and the overbearing presence of her siblings. Minas, meanwhile, could hardly wait until their honeymoon trip to Greece, when he would walk into his parents' crowded home in Finicky with this stunning girl who spoke English as fluently as she spoke Greek, a stylish, modern, clever American wife who nevertheless would fulfill his every need, waiting on him and adoring him like a concubine, while his brothers and sisters stared in envy. I watched the progress of Tina and Minas' courtship with reservations, secretly glad that I had not yet encountered something as tumultuous as true love. My most pressing problem was finding a good job so I could save money for college. My benefactor turned out to be the same person who had served as Glycaria's best man and Tina's matchmaker, Gregory Bocas. One day in May, Bocas called long distance from Philadelphia to congratulate Glycaria and Procopi on the birth of Photios. Boca talked to each of us in turn, quizzing Tina on her wedding plans. When he learned I hadn't been able to find a job, he offered me $75 a week to manage his restaurant in Ocean City, New Jersey, for the summer, and a room in the back of it where I could sleep. It didn't take me long to accept. Free of the need to pay my family for room and board, I could save all of my earnings, and the chance to leave O'Connor's lunch counter to spend a summer on the beach was too tempting to refuse. In 1958, before the days of drugs, race riots, and protest movements, Ocean City was the perfect American family resort. Liquor was prohibited on the island, and there was a strong Christian moral emphasis. Bolstered by the many churches, Gregory Bocas' restaurant was called Ocean View, and, like all the other restaurants on the boardwalk, it did such a good business during the summer that customers had to wait in line outside the door during rush hours. Gregory, his wife Sophia, and their three small children lived in rooms behind the restaurant next to the one I occupied. Gregory ran the kitchen while I handled the dining room from 7 a.m. through the dinner hour, which usually finished by 8:30, so I could lock up by 9. Whenever things got quiet in the afternoon, I could sneak off for a swim. Sophia couldn't work out front because she couldn't speak English, and Bocas was very insistent that no Greek be spoken in the hearing of the customers. "They don't like foreigners around here," he warned me, and it was true that on several occasions, arriving customers turned away when they heard me speak to Sophia in Greek. After closing up the restaurant about 9 every night, I would head across the street to Summers Point, along with every other restless youth in search of a lively evening. Summers Point was a noisy collection of nightclubs where thirsty residents of Ocean City could find a drink, musical entertainment, and congenial company. The main attraction was a huge club called Tony Mart's, where an immense rectangular bar surrounded a raised bandstand, and the customers were jammed body to body against the bar. At Tony Mart's, fledgling musical groups singing and playing the hot new sound rock and roll got their start in those summers of the late 1950s. It was a clean-cut, collegiate kind of clientele who frequented Summers Point in those years. The men in Bermuda shorts and crew cuts, the girls with sun-bleached hair and tanned legs. Their main goal every evening was to get falling down drunk and then to spend the next day bragging about the size of their hangovers. Since I never was very interested in drinking, this was not my idea of a good time. If I didn't manage to pick up a girl at Tony Mart's by 11, I would take a taxi back to the Ocean View and be asleep by midnight. But at least a couple of nights a week, I would manage to convince some young woman to accompany me back in the taxi and would sneak her into my room. Those 3 months in Ocean City were the golden summer of my youth. I had it all. Money, authority, sun, sand, and sex. I'd spend steamy nights nursing a screwdriver and listening to Fever, Blueberry Hill, and Hard-Headed Woman while wedged into a throbbing, screaming mass of tanned bodies perfumed with cocoa butter, and then ride back to the edge of the sea to embrace one of those smooth golden girls in my single bed with the crash of the surf in the distance. My summer idyll ended with a jolt after Labor Day when I returned home with $600 in my pocket, proudly paid off the last of my court fines, and then discovered that because of the recession, I couldn't find a job anywhere. I had given my place at O'Connor's into a Greek friend, thinking that when I got back with my new experience in management, I could land a much better position. The unpleasant truth was that I couldn't even find a work as a soda jerk. Before I learned the futility of my job hunting, there was the pleasant distraction of Tina's wedding to Minus on September 7. Despite our straitened finances, we managed to put together a respectable party in Putnam and Thurston using Tina's savings. So many compatriots arrived from Philadelphia that the Greek houses of Worcester were overflowing with guests. It was a melding of the two great expatriate communities from our province, and my father reigned over it all like a king, breaking dishes, dancing, and balancing wine glasses, while Tina, in her white lace dress and long train, looked like a vision from the movies. Minas was so proud and excited, he never stopped talking and toasting his bride with ouzo. Hardly had they boarded the plane for their honeymoon when rumors began filtering back to us of disagreements between the newlyweds. She wanted to go to her village first to introduce her groom and to weep over her mother's grave. He was afraid she'd upset herself too much with mourning, and besides, he wanted to visit his own village first to show off his bride. There were reports of shouting matches and tears, and of Tina setting out from Minas Village one day on foot down the dusty mountain road until he caught up with her and convinced her to come back. When they settled in Philadelphia, the disturbing reports continued. The argument over which one had rejected more admirers came up frequently, always ending with shouts and tears. Tina didn't seem to find Philadelphia as gratifying as she had expected. My father and Kanta went down several times to resolve conflicts, and Tina's in-laws also tried to smooth the rough spots in the marriage. Finally, everyone concluded that Tina, who had suffered the tragic loss of her mother under such terrifying circumstances, probably needed to live near her sisters to feel secure and happy. So Minas and Tina moved to Worcester and rented an apartment not far from Chandler Street. Now the battles were so close we began to feel shell-shocked. Once I came home to find my father sitting at the kitchen table weeping over his inability to make his father's married life a happy one. My sisters counseled her to have a baby. That would settle everything. But it didn't, although Tina and Minus produced both a daughter and a son. In the end, after 15 tumultuous years, they decided to part. We all felt saddened, but were also relieved that the agonizing arguments were over, and they would have a chance to find peace separately. As Tina and Minus set off for Greece on their honeymoon, I returned to the discouraging rounds of job hunting. After a month of fruitless searching, I gave up and took a part-time job that made my days at O'Connor's look like a paid vacation. I began working as a short-order cook on the lobster shift at a White Tower hamburger shop from midnight to 8 a.m. for 90 cents an hour. Working all night, I finished the final semester of high school like a zombie, completely out of sync with the rest of the world. I would come home from school at 2, sleep until 8, do homework until midnight, then work at the White Tower until school started. Working nights in one of the seediest parts of Worcester introduced me to the underbelly of the city. After 2 a.m., when the bars closed, the serious drinkers came in for something to eat, and often vomited on the counter or dozed off into their hamburgers while I had to clean up after them. Every morning, I headed to school more disgusted than the day before. During the slow hours of the night shift, I filled out college applications, daydreaming about how my life would change if I could only get a scholarship. I applied to every college within 200 miles, counting on my good grade point average and awards to win me something. Finally, by Christmas, unable to stand the White Tower any longer, I gave notice and I quit. That Christmas was one of the worst I remember. I sat around the house contemplating my bleak future. In only a few more weeks, I would be finished with high school and unemployed. I've got to raise money for college somehow, but I can't go back to the White Tower, I confided to my father in despair. Why should you be a short-order cook? He asked sharply. That's okay for me, but you're smarter and better educated. You said you wanted to work for a newspaper, so go for it. There's only one paper around here, the Telegram and Gazette, and they'd never take me without a college degree or experience, I replied. We'll see about that, he mused. I'm going to talk to Charlie Davis. All those big shots from the Gazette eat at his restaurant every day. Don't go asking Charlie Davis for any favors, I exclaimed. Why should you be obligated to that guy when he threw you out after all those years? A man with no jobs and no prospects can't afford to ride a high horse, Father replied. Charlie has always taken a personal interest in you. Just let me talk to him. After all, it's the Christmas season. I'll pay him a little holiday visit to wish him Cronia Pola. Shortly after the new year, Charlie Davis called me and told me to come to Putnam and Thurston the next afternoon, bringing the clippings of my stories from the high school paper and my academic records. Like my father, Charlie was short, stocky man who walked with great dignity, swinging an umbrella like a walking stick. With the grandeur of a lord, he led me out of his restaurant, across Worcester Common behind City Hall, and into the portals of the Worcester Telegram and Evening Gazette, the city's commonly held morning and afternoon papers. Charlie was greeted with deference by everyone and passed straight up to the imposing offices of the editor-in-chief, who welcomed him like an old friend. He eventually sent us on to the executive editor, who, after reviewing my clippings, offered me a job in the promotion department starting at $60 a week. I accepted at once, even though I had no idea what promotion meant. It was a foothold in the newspaper business, and that was my dream. Afterward, on the pavement, I thanked Charlie Davis for getting me the job. Don't mention it, Nick, he said kindly. I like to see a young man, especially a Greek, who knows what he wants and will work for it. I quickly discovered that promotion was another word for public relations. The head of the department, a short, excitable man who scurried about the office constantly blowing his nose, had three young women and me working for him. As a junior member of the team, I was assigned jobs like going to merchants for testimonials. I sold my car in the Telegram and Gazette classifieds and writing ads promoting upcoming features. I loved working for the paper, feeling the tension all around me as reporters raced to meet deadlines and the wire service machines clattered to life with another news bulletin. But it was frustrating being sidelined in the promotion department when I longed to be in the newsroom where reporters chronicled the important events of the world beneath a permanent haze of cigarette smoke. Whenever there was a lull in my promotional duties, I would sneak into the newsroom and try to coerce the lean, laconic city editor, Steve Donahue, into assigning me something, anything, to write. Sometimes he shooed me away, but other times he threw me a crumb, articles about the weather or city high school activities or obituaries of Greek immigrants. My first break came one day in March when a freak wind blew the roof off a large warehouse in Auburn. All the reporters were out on the street, and in desperation, Donahue called me over. I grabbed a taxi and rushed to where a number of workmen were standing, scratching their heads at the sight of the decapitated building. Just like a real reporter, I asked all the right questions, and that night, I was thrilled to see my prose on the front page of the Evening Gazette. I was deflated, however, when I realized there was no byline. The next day, I asked the city editor why. "I'm really sorry, Nick," Donahue replied. "I wanted to give you a byline, but the problem is that the unpronounceable name of yours, Nicholas Nagioinis, just won't fit in a single column of type. You're either going to have to get a shorter name or remain anonymous." One Sunday, I was sitting on the floor of the parlor with two former schoolmates, the Rosenberg twins, reading the Sunday New York Times, which I bought every weekend. I was studying the entertainment section, as usual, when I saw an article heralding the opening of the annual Shakespeare Festival at Stratford, Connecticut. "Look at the cast," I exclaimed to my friends. "Othello, starring Alfred Drake, and Earl Hyman. God, I wish I had a car. I'd give anything to see that. It's my favorite Shakespeare play." My father, sitting nearby, overheard me and asked, "Who is this Shakespeare?" "The only dramatist who can stand beside Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides without shame," I answered. "Then of course you must go," he said. "I'll drive you and your friends to Connecticut." It was an odd group that set out in my father's 7-year-old green Plymouth, but I was exhilarated at the thought of seeing the performance, especially since Donahue had given me permission to write a review for the Gazette. "It'll give us a little class reviewing the Shakespeare Festival," he said, had said, smiling. My father sat silent through the performance. As he drove us back towards Worcester afterwards, I asked him, "Did you understand it at all?" "Not all the words," he replied, "but the story, yes." "That Igo was a bastard. Did you like it?" Phil Rosenberg asked him. "Yes, Shakespeare is a great man," he answered. "The movies, the good people win in the end, but Shakespeare tell the truth. In life, the bastards always win." I labored over my review almost until morning, and when I finished, I typed at the top a new version of my name, borrowed from the nickname given to my father by his cronies, Dr. Gage. The next evening, the Evening Gazette appeared with a review of Othello by the paper's Shakespearean correspondent, the previously unknown Nicholas Gage. Donahue complimented me on the review and congratulated me on my first byline. Then he asked me what I planned to do with my life. I told him about my dream of working on a newspaper, my lack of money, and the college acceptances I couldn't afford. "It's important that you go to college, Nick," he advised. It doesn't have to be Princeton. I went to Boston University, and they've got a first-rate communication school, and they cost a lot less." "But it's too late even to apply," I said. "Not necessarily," he replied. "I'll give them a call and see what I can do. Meanwhile, you call everyone who might have scholarship funds. Your church, Greek organizations, your high school, the Chamber of Commerce." Steve Donahue called his alma mater, sang my praises, and guaranteed me a job as a reporter on the Gazette during my summer vacations. And suddenly, I was accepted by Boston University with a scholarship of $500. Then I was awarded $400 by AHIPA, the American Hellenic Educational Progressive Association. Tuition for a year at BU was only $950. So if I added in the $600 I had saved, I figured I could just manage to pay for room and board. And the next summer, according to Donahue, I would at least be able to sit in the city room, a real reporter. By the time the summer was over, I could hardly wait to pack my dime store footlocker and get on the bus for Boston. I couldn't afford new clothes or luxuries like a typewriter, but what I lacked in material goods, I made up for in anticipation of this new world, which would educate me so I would never need to earn my living flipping hamburgers or selling fruit. On the first day of September, when Father drove me in his Plymouth to the bus station, seeing of so many assignations between my Greek friends and the girls of Worcester, he followed me to my bus, then handed me a $50 bill. "This is all I can give you for college," he said, with an expression I had never seen before. "I'm sorry you weren't lucky enough to have a rich father." Then he turned to walk off with the stiff gait of an old man. "Goodbye, Patera," I called after him. "I'll be back for Thanksgiving." But if he heard me, he didn't give a sign. On the bus, I alternated between admiring the landscape along Route 9, which seemed to have taken on a new brilliance since my high school days, and counting the money I had in my wallet. I had to find an apartment and a job in the city, and even with the most stringent economizing, I wasn't sure I could stretch my funds to last until Christmas. Chapter 16, Higher Education. Man can learn nothing without being taught. As soon as I arrived at Boston University and found my way to the College of General Education, I left my luggage and went out to find a room. All freshmen were expected to live in a university dormitory, but that cost $855 a year, more than I could afford. I walked the side streets near campus and finally found a sign in a window on St. Mary Street in a once patrician brownstone that had been turned into a boarding house. The room facing the street cost only $8 a week, less than half what I'd have to pay in a dorm. Pleased that I had accomplished so much so fast, I returned to the campus to collect my things. I unpacked sheets for the bed and a large photograph of my six small nephews and one niece lined up against the backyard fence on Chandler Street, their arms around each other's shoulders. It made me homesick for the commotion of our three-decker. I placed a sack of Greek coffee and the copper briquette for boiling it on the bedside table so the pungent aroma of the coffee would remind me of home. Then I took out bottles of Mactoxa brandy and clear ouzo that I had brought as well in case anyone ever came to visit me. Despite my homesickness, I soon made friends at BU, most of them from blue-collar families who couldn't afford Ivy League schools. But when classes were over, I would go back to my room and find the silence unbearable. If I went to the library, it was worse. It was so quiet that I couldn't concentrate. After years of doing my homework on the kitchen table, surrounded by the comforting chaos of my family, as an unending stream of relatives and visitors came and went. I looked for the office of the college paper, the BU News, during the first week of classes. There I found the city editor, Jim Savage, who asked to see the clippings of articles I had done for the Evening Gazette. When he read the review of Othello, he stuck out a hand and grunted, "Congratulations, you're the new drama critic." I attended every campus theatrical production and interviewed the occasional theater or film personality who visited the campus to speak. Unfortunately, there was no budget to pay for tickets to legitimate the theaters in Boston. But as a university critic, I was one of the first to praise the thespian skills of a talented drama major in the School of Fine Arts, a plump brunette named Faye Dunaway, who later became a slender blonde film star in Bonnie and Clyde. The BU news staff were a group of bright, funny, compatible students who, like me, were smitten with journalism. We tended to gather after classes in the newspaper office, polishing stories, studying, and hanging out until a group went on to the nearby Peter Pan restaurant for hamburgers. I ordered coffee, mindful of my budget. It was tempting to linger with them, but I knew I had to find a paying job if I was going to remain in college. I looked in the Boston phone book for every firm that began with the words Greek and Hellenic and discovered a newspaper called the Hellenic Chronicle in downtown Boston. Certain that Providence was leading me, I took the subway to Copley Square and met the publisher, Peter Agres, a tall, husky Greek-American World War II vet who had gone to BU on the GI Bill and then pursued his dream of founding an English-language newspaper for the American-born sons and daughters of Greek immigrants. I know there's a large number of educated, prosperous, second-generation Greeks out there who are interested in Greek affairs, but better at reading English than Greek, he told me. A lot of them are forgetting their heritage, but we're trying to find them and remind them of what they're losing. You have been listening to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Naomi. Thank you for listening.
Are you having difficulty with your eyesight? Are you losing your vision? Are you afraid of what comes next? If you're blind or visually impaired, contact Mass Commission for the Blind to find out if you're eligible to register for services. Learn new skills to reclaim your independence. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls, where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl-blind.org.